Now I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, Lauren from Menifee.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Lauren Alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Those flyers, there's so many events. How could you be bored at AA? Okay, so I want to thank John for asking me. I want to thank Mike for giving me the rundown and seeing. It's great to be here. And I want to thank Dana for joining me and meeting me for dinner. Anyways, I live in Menifee, so, and Dana lives in San Diego. I just want to make sure y'all can hear me. Are we good? Okay. And I used to live here, and I don't live here anymore. And every once in a while, I have to accept the fact that I don't live here anymore. And it's been well over 2 years that I've lived in Riverside County, but I still be like, oh, San Diego, oh, so like the. Anyways, nostalgia. Happy 90 days, Josh, wherever you are. There you are. Congratulations on your token, 90 days. And welcome to the two new people. And I'm going to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, just like it was read by Josh, that's what it says I'm going to do. And so I'll just say that I loved to drink. I absolutely love alcohol. I love everything about alcohol. I like what alcohol does for me. I like what it does for you. I like what it does for, like, I just, there's no, I can't find anything wrong with it, you know? So that's just my take on that. And my sobriety date is November 28th, 2005. I got sober the day after my 26th birthday, and I'm 46 years old. I will just say that when I first came to AA, this was the last thing that I wanted to do. I did not think that I was an alcoholic. I thought that I was just going to come here and check it out, and I was going to see what you all had going on, and I would also like exclude it from my list of issues. Like, I'm just going to go there. Oh, and hi, Dave. It's good to see you. Sorry. So I was going to come to AA and say, well, you know what? I have a bunch of other problems, but alcohol's not drinking is not going to fix it. So that's why I came here. But there's a lot more for me to say about that. But I just cannot not say how much my life has changed since I walked through those doors. I cannot not emphasize what a different person I am today. And so I just have to preface that anything I say here, just know that the girl that you're looking at here in front of you, nothing about this dialogue here is what I brought with me. Life was an absolute disaster. But also at the same time, I also thought I had it going on. So there's a little bit of like balance. I had my first drink here. I used to live in North County, San Diego. I went to high school here. My father was a colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve. And so we moved a bunch until settling down. He was active duty for a long, long time. And then he went to the reserves, and that's where he really moved up the ranks. But right, so military family through and through. And we settled in San Diego, and I went to school up in Rancho Peñasquitas. And my first drink was non-remarkable, like, you know, North County living, y'all. It wasn't cool back then. Like, PQ was just, like, not the place. Now, oh, my gosh. But back then, it was, like, it was just a bunch of dirt when we moved there, and they didn't even have a grocery store. So, alcohol wasn't transformative. I had a couple drinks. We got in trouble because we drank from my parents' liquor cabinet. My parents didn't drink. There wasn't partying going on in my home. I wasn't around drinkers. My dad wasn't the kind of Marine to like hit it hard. We just had a really, you know, I will say there's a ton of function. Wait, I'm trying to make sure I don't do it backwards. But there was a lot of love, but not a lot of function as when it came to certain things. And so, yeah, that I just had a great time when I drank. And I'm in the middle of three girls. My poor father, he never had any sons. And this is it's just ironic because I learned how to mow the lawn, and I learned how to change the oil in the car. I learned how to rotate the tires and what that looked like. And my dad never really had anybody to really receive that. But I was like the one kid who was just like, I don't know, along for the ride of whatever he would say. And so, yeah, sure, Dad, let's go to the shooting range. Yeah, sure, Dad. So, yeah, it was kind of easy. But don't worry, my older sister really hit it hard. And so I made a real clear decision when I was young, because my older sister was in and out of rehab. And I was like, I'm never going to get like her. And so that was my decision. I'm like, I'm never going to get as bad as her. And if the worst thing I do is drink, big deal, right? Because she was really hitting the hard stuff, super young, like 16, ODing like crazy. And so I'm just the middle child. I flew under the radar. but I got really sharp on certain things. And some of the things I got sharp with, which I later learned, you know, in our literature here, was, you know, kind of a little bit of step two action. You know, I got really self-reliant. I didn't follow authority. Someone said they didn't like authority. I think it was Josh who said that he'd have a real problem with authority, okay? I just knew to tell authority one thing and do another. I just learned right away, if I'm going to fix my problems, I'm going to fix them myself. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to ask for any help. I'm just going to take care of my business. No drama. And it was the most dramatic thing to do. And I created problems in my life all the time. And absolute chaos, absolute insanity. And so I would do these kind of things. Like I'd be going to call. I don't want to go too far. I made friends with the attendance office. And so when it was time for me, I would want to take some time off of school to have a little day drinking with my friends, you know, the harmless stuff. I'd forge a doctor's note and I would slide that note across the table. You know, I'm friendly face, dimples, you know, la la, and off I go. And so, but I wasn't going to, you know, make up the work. It was just a straight C decision all the time. And so I just flew under the radar. But when things started getting dodgy, you know, it was that time where you're supposed to be graduating high school, and I could definitely graduate high school, but I certainly wasn't doing anything like taking the SATs or applying to colleges. That wasn't part of my thing. What I was getting around that time was, see, my sister had lost all these privileges because she kept getting in trouble with the law. So I got her military ID that she had sold. I think I bought it from her, and we looked alike. And so I could go to the bars in Tijuana because I did like to drink. And so I was like, and honestly, here we are in Chula Vista, guys. Like, I can just feel it. Like, I'm so close. Like, just drive a little bit longer and I know exactly what to do. Actually, this was like 1995. So I don't actually know what to do anymore. But back then I knew what to do. And so, yeah, I had a couple of coworkers. I worked at my little jobs. And at 16, I'm just driving across the border down to Tijuana, having a good time at the bars. And if you did that, you know what it looks like the next day. Like, no one's coming home before 4. Like, if you're home before 4, you did not actually have a good night. You got to go all the way. And sometimes the sun's rising across the 15 freeway, and it's like, isn't life amazing? You know, it was just, I loved it. And they didn't care. So I had this idea. It looked like her. It looked like me, but it was her. And so I could tell you like her astrological sign. I could tell her birthday. I could just tell you anything about her because I needed to know my stuff if I ever got grilled. I used that ID even in casinos. I don't know what I was thinking. a military ID did kind of work. But okay, I just want to clarify. There's really serious consequences to do that. Don't ever do that. It's a terrible thing to use a fraudulent military ID. It's a terrible, bad thing. But if you want to talk about some self-reliance here, I was never willing to consider the consequences. I was never going to get caught. That was my mentality. And right, it was just regular drinking in a sense, but I was playing roulette really early on. And right, and I remember one time we almost got pulled over, and I had a police officer really on our tail. And I mean, there was I was driving like 45 in a 65. It wasn't 65 then. I was like driving 45 on the freeway. It was bad, and I didn't get in trouble. And I remember being like, I'm never driving in Tijuana ever again. And I made the oath. And like 4 days later, I'm like, well, I'll just park close to the border and walk across, you know. And it's always these negotiations. So I wasn't. That self-reliance of I'm just going to set this note across the table and forge my mom's signature, and then I would be sure to capture the answering machine at home, delete the messages. I just had my situations handled. And so the things got a little escalated. There was some violence in my home. There's a lot of fighting. And it wasn't coming from the colonel. It was coming from other stuff, right? And so I was the least problematic. And so I had another great idea. I had a friend from high school. I had visited her boyfriend up in Santa Barbara. He moved to Isla Vista, and he's going to City College. And he didn't have to take the SATs. They take anybody. And there's a dorm you can live in there if you do the paperwork. And what am I good at? I'm good at paperwork. I've always been really good. I have no problem pushing paper. It's always been the little jobs I've had. To this day, man, if your HOA needs help, I'm your girl. Like, I just do papers. And I put the paperwork in, and there they went. And my parents just said, yeah, sure, whatever, go ahead. And it opened up a whole new horizon for me. I moved to Santa Barbara when I was 17 years old. I have no idea why they bought this package I sold them. But I moved into a dorm. I didn't have any money, so I got this part-time job at a Shell station and a Subway sandwich shop. And I just like worked and drank, and I had this outside appearance of going to school. and I work and drink, and I just get in all these situations and problems, and I would never ask for help, and I would always fix them. My situation is that my solutions are worse than my problems. I would always make things harder on myself, take the longer way. I never took the easier, softer way, but I took the way of my logic. And so, right, it was easy for me to understand when I started coming to AA that my thinking is what got me here, because I had so many examples of any normal person. Like, it happens a lot with me today with my sponsees. They're telling me the situation. They're telling me the bill collector's calling, and I'm just like, can you call them back and tell them the payment terms? Like, just call them and tell them. And they're like, no. I'm like, I don't blame you. I wouldn't want to take that direction either. The phone sucks. But try, call them. See, and she calls me back and she goes, oh my God, I only have to pay like $150 this month. They're not going to take the whole $1,000. Like, why? And she goes, well, if I call them, it's such an easy thing to do that they'll give me a forgiveness plan. And I'm like, it's great. It's easy for me to see that as a third party. I'm an outsider. When I'm in my own problems, I can't see that. That was exactly the way I was until I came here. And even still for a while afterwards, because, you know, you get sober, you stop drinking, and it's like turning the electricity off on the ceiling fan. The blades of the fan still spin. The inertia of my life is still going. All of that just sounds fantastic and wonderful, but drinking really got dark for me. And what it looks like is I transferred to the university up in that city after a number of years. I made, again, unsurprising, terrible decisions. Had a lot of financial problems, a lot of debt. I had a couple of solutions to those problems, and one of them was in case I needed to have some extra money, there was a program in that area where you could sell your eggs, and I did that. I did that when I was 20 years old. I did other things, like not just the Turnpike Shell Station. I did some other stuff, crazy just ways to kind of like fix my problems without asking for help. One time I did study abroad. I got into a terrible relationship, and the solution for that was I'm going to apply to the study abroad program, and that person caught me having a I'll just call it an overlap, but it was just a mess. And so rather than deal with or communicate about any of those situations, I saw a flyer, and the flyer said, if you apply, you can get accepted to this program. I'm really good at paperwork. And in 6 weeks, I was on an airplane to England. And that was my solution to that relationship and to those the grades and the school situations, because it would look really good on a resume. And that's what I said. And it did look good on the outside. My parents could say, oh, well, yeah, she's taking an extra, 4 years at college, but she's doing this. And it like worked for a Christmas card. And I came back like 60 pounds heavier from that trip because the drinking age, my real ID worked. I turned 20 years, I don't know how old I was, guys. I turned a certain age when I was over there, and I could drink in the bars without a problem. And I hit every pint ever could possibly get my hands on. And again, socially, it looked fine. And this was 1999. It was before September 11. You could get on a train, take a train to any country. You guys, drinking was the best. However, I rolled off that airplane, and I had thrown up on myself on the plane. I had woken up in a different seat. I had lost my shoes. And that was the last thing my classmates saw of me from that trip. Alcohol was working for me then. That's just what it was. So I came back to my whatever life, and I kept trying, and it was time to graduate college, and the time had come, y'all. The train was at the station, and I needed to get on, and it was time. And I, not only was I not a candidate for graduation, I was on academic probation, and not only was I on academic probation, but I also was never going to get a degree in the field of study that I had, because I'd failed too many classes within that category, and I never was going to get it. And it was just like, see a counselor? No. Forge the paperwork to make it look like I could cross the line. And I did that. I sat up one night and I was drinking. I made the decision when I was sober. Again, self-reliance is failing me. My thinking is the problem. That's the issue. But I was drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon, and I was going to the FedEx Kinko's, and I went and I photocopied the documents that my roommates had to walk the line for them to graduate college, and I made them with my name. And then that's what I presented across the line. And this was the internet, like horizon was just budding. We were using attachment paper clips to send documents via email for the first time. And so it was as a paperwork process. And there was no problem that I could do that paperwork. And I slid that card across, and the guy said my name. And I actually did make a plan, though. My plan was to go back and retake those classes. but you had to have money for that, and you had to have a job, and you can't do both at the same time and go to school full time. And so like, I don't know, man, I'll figure it out later. Have a drink. And so it just was these piles, my problems piled up and were astonishingly difficult to solve. I could see myself black and white in the big book when I read that stuff. And right, I started, my parents, everyone came to the graduation. My great grandmother, she lived to be 102 years old. She's on an airplane flying out to see me graduate. My grandparents, my aunt and uncle, my nephew, his girlfriend, all my sisters, my mom, my dad. And I'm the only kid in the family who's doing this alleged graduation. And it's like all the farce. And so you just got to drink on that. You just can't, I couldn't sit in my skin, right? And I went to the bar early that morning with my friends and we drank and I walked the line and I put that picture on my desk of me shaking the chancellor's hand. And I even mailed out announcements. You guys, my mom was just like so proud, and it was all a farce. So you're right. It was just difficult for me to do that. And I drank on that for a long time because the lie was so big and I couldn't find a way to unring that bell. So flash forward, I have a go nowhere job. Everyone thinks, except for a couple of my roommates knew, but, just to give you an example, my roommates at that time, I lived with four gals towards the end, like the last chunk of time that I was living in Isla Vista. I had four roommates, and three of the four are in 12-step program. And one of them got sober before me, and she's the one who I talked to. And I'll just tell you right now, you know, like I was in another relationship. The guy broke up with me over my drinking. He sat me down and he said, I'm sick of watching you drink like you're trying to kill yourself. If you don't stop drinking that way, I'm out of here. And I couldn't even make it 6 hours. I was drinking again. And this is the guy who was patiently letting me change the sheets because I was a wet bed alcoholic. And he knew, like, we were just things we weren't talking about. And so I confessed into her a portion of what was going on in that relationship. And she like couldn't get the words out fast enough to me to be like, I'm sober for a year in another 12-step program. And I want to tell you all about it. And I was like, what? Like it was a lot. But I'd only told her that image of just the tip of the iceberg. And underneath it was a world of information that she had no idea about it. Yeah. And so, yeah, three out of the four of us are sober in 12-step programs. So like we find each other, you know, a bunch of magnets. Like you drink like I drink. Let's go. And it's just, and more like too, like you'll look away from my problems. Like I'll look away from yours. Let's go. So I'd really ostracized myself from my family. None of them had any real interaction in my day-to-day life. Facebook wasn't around yet. Like we weren't doing socials. They would believe what I told them on the phone, and that's what they knew. And my parents had since moved back to Fredericksburg, Virginia, where my dad had gone back for some military stuff in the private sector. And, so I was just me doing my thing. And when she had told me that she was sober, and she knew all of my lies to that, you know, iceberg, just the tip. And she said to me, Lauren, I think you're an alcoholic and you should go to AA and it's free. And there were many things that have happened to me, guys. But for some reason, she said it's free. And I thought to myself, well, I guess I'll go. And thank God for the seventh tradition, because I didn't understand. I thought you had to have all this money to go to rehab. I thought you needed to do this whole stuff. I don't know. I had no experience and no exposure to sobriety, to recovery, to 12-step program of any kind. The very first time I ever had any experience was when I emailed the central office in Santa Barbara. And he's since passed away, but Tim Whitcomb was just a really great person of service in that community. And he's somebody who, he was managing central office at the time. And he was such a good example, too. He would always have volunteers. Yeah, Dave knows Tim. Yeah, and he would always have these volunteers answer the phone. And if he had to take a 12-step call, it was like a chess game. He would stop the timer on his work there because he wasn't going to be paid for that phone call. And then when he got off of that phone call, his time would resume for the day. And I emailed central office because I was afraid y'all were watching me. I was super paranoid. And so I couldn't call, but I found the website, you know, loading website. And I found the information, and he emailed me back with all of these recommendations to go to women's meetings. And I think I still have the email somewhere. I think I might have printed it out because it was such a weird, it was so weird. I don't know why he thought to recommend women's meetings, but that's what he did. And I went to that night because my friend told me that I could just go to AA. I don't know. All I know is that I was fantasizing about ways to die and to kill myself to make it look like an accident because when I drank, my head would be so loud still. And I hear people say that alcohol wasn't working for them. And I don't really have an opinion on that, because alcohol for me is just, it was just rolling the dice. You never knew if I was going to get like fall down drunk Lauren, funny Lauren, angry Lauren, punch a wall, angry Lauren, unstuff a pillow, angry Lauren, maybe I'll threaten to stab you. Like, you guys never knew what you were going to get with me. I could make a friend at a bar and I'm like, oh, we should plan a vacation together. And we're literally talking about places we want to travel. Absolute stranger. You never knew what you were going to get. And I remember one of the last times I was drinking, I had gone out to a bar and I was physically fall down drunk. I remember I was falling down and my friends would just pick me back up. But my head, I remember it. My head was clear. And that was just a total betrayal. So yeah, that's what it was like for me. Sometimes wet in the bed, sometimes violent, sometimes blacked out, sometimes totally present. And I'm very, very familiar with what it's like to walk around in the morning and wonder, how did my car get there? Or where is my car? Or going through the phone log of who did I call? Just the blackouts were terrible. Right, so I never got a DUI. Didn't think I was an alcoholic. So I found myself in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous after just that craziness. And I remember they went around the room and they said, everyone said their name and their illness. And they got to me and I said, my name is Lauren and I don't know what I am. And I started crying. And the ladies were really sympathetic to me. And shortly after that, they did birthdays. Do you guys still put the cake through the window if someone's having a birthday? Okay, well, you know, AA birthdays are so special. We're just the terrible singers and we have these crazy cakes that come out of like the cake hole. And there's, at my very first meeting, they were doing cakes and tokens, and I had just turned 26 years old the day before, and I had no idea what goes on here, and I'm crying, having just said my alcohol, or I don't know what I am, and I said, I'm 26, and they were so nice to me, and they're like, honey, sit down, it's not that kind of birthday, and they were so patient with me. But if you want to talk about awkward beginnings, I got you covered. There's nothing you can do that I haven't done already. Very weird in AA, so welcome, you fit right in. Right, so they sat me down, but the women were sharing. Even the first person that shared, she was staring. She's sober over 20 years, and I'm sober 20 years now, but she really had, she said things to me, like, and in her share about wetting the bed, and then she laughed. And everyone kind of chuckled, and they elbowed, and they leaned back in their chair, and they had a piece about them, and I wanted to die. Because not only was that a secret that you don't tell anybody, but also it was something that no way was I ever picturing that I could just be relaxed about something that I was so shameful of. But not just that, the list was long of the many things I was ashamed of. There's a part in the book that always rings my bell. It talks about remorse, and then we're sore at ourselves. And I've gone to know that as pride in reverse. That's me, pride in reverse, right? But that remorse, I felt so hopeless, it blocked out all ideas of solution. It also blocked out my ability to connect with you. I could never even remember somebody's name when we had a conversation because I'm so obsessed with self. I had no idea that was alcoholism. Right. I could never even understand that negative thoughts of self were still thoughts of self. Telling myself I'm an idiot, I'm a jerk, I'm a liar, I'm a cheat, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Well, all of that's taking me out of me being able to even pay attention to you. And I'm wondering why I feel so terrible about myself. And I'm wondering why all of my friends aren't friends with me anymore. And I'm wondering why all of my relationships keep starting off like a firework and a rocket ship and then spoiling away. And I'm walking around saying, well, I'm a victim of circumstance and poor situation. And none of that was the truth. I would bring me everywhere. So I had a boyfriend once, and he didn't drink, and he didn't drink on purpose. And I remember when I first started talking to him, it was on purpose, because this guy would be a better influence on me. Not because I was attracted to him not drinking. It was because I told myself the only reason why I drank is I was around too many people that drank. Well, okay, alcohol for me, I am physically allergic to it, right? If I take a drink, I've lost all control. I have no decision making of whether how much I'm going to drink that night or anything else I'm going to put in my body. Am I going to smoke? Am I not going to smoke? I don't know. It doesn't matter. All bets are off because I'm just going to have that first drink. And I have the phenomenon of craving, right? I'm totally obsessed with that drink. Only I'm playing it cool, and you would never know. I didn't know that was alcoholism. I didn't know that people would go on places like on vacation and not be completely hungover the whole time. I had no idea that people didn't have crippling debt. I had no idea that. It just blew me away. And so like when we got to that part in the book where it talked about men and women drink, I think it's in Doctor's Opinion, they drink for the effect produced by alcohol. And I'm over here going, wait, there's people that don't? I just never occurred to me. You guys, I'm like, why would they even put that in writing? It's like people blink, people breathe, people drink. It just, none of it ever occurred to me. And I don't know, I consider myself kind of a sharp cookie. I mean, I could forge my way out of anything, but I didn't understand that that is what was happening. I really want to say something important that I did when I was 7 years sober before I forget, is I did go back to school. At 7 years sober, I took those classes that I had failed again. Some of them, it was for the third time. When I tell you the persistence that I learned from the tools in this program are invaluable to me. On my wall, I have framed, I got a paralegal certification before I could finish my undergraduate degree because I was just going back to school in general. So I have my UC Santa Barbara Extension document that says paralegal certification under one name because I had a different name. I've had multiple names. And then I have the announcement that my mom that my mom sent to all of her friends and out in the Christmas card, and that's next to the frame. And then I have the real diploma, and they're decades different, all of them. And it's all for the same thing, right? And I just look, I only learned in Alcoholics Anonymous how to sit in the front row, because I would do commitments at meetings, and I had to sit in the front row to do the jobs, right? I learned how to ask for help from the counselors and the teachers in order to make the amends. I learned how to, if I didn't understand something, not only ask for help, but I could set aside more time and study more. None of this was something that I knew how to do. I didn't speak the academic language, although I really, really tried. But that step two thing, that, you know, the insanity of my thinking and the insanity of my self-reliance, it was going to kill me. But it also taught me terrible tools, and I had to stop using all of those tools. I got a little bit ahead of myself, but when I started coming to meetings, not only was I deeply, deeply saddened to identify as much as I did, but I also started feeling so physically good. I had no idea that the solution to my problem was actually causing my problem. I mean, like, drinking was like a clock, you know? I would have terrible anxiety. I would be sitting at my desk at work and someone would walk by and I would jump and be like, why are you sneaking up on me? And so I have not just that anxiety, but personal relationship problems, financial problems, and the clock keeps ticking and I have to have a drink. And then as a result of drinking, I would have terrible remorse and anxiety, and you never knew what I was going to wake up as or wake up to. I would drink at 3 a.m. I would drink first thing in the morning. And I didn't know that it was because I had to drink to feel better. I had no idea that what I was doing was creating my problem. And I could say just have one drink, but I certainly was not getting any relief and I wasn't enjoying myself. And if I had more than one drink, I was absolutely out of control. And there was never a middle. There was never peace, and I never had any of it. And I heard, the more I went to meetings, the more I could identify. I never recognized my drinking as blackout. I never recognized my drinking and driving as a crime. I always thought of myself as like, I'm fine. And the more I came to meetings, the more I identified. And that's why meetings are so important. I don't know whatever is going to happen in the technology world. I have absolutely no opinion on any of it. But I do know that nothing will ever change for me the experience of one alcoholic talking to another. The mental relief that I experience, perhaps it's like the dialysis and my kidney is the alcoholism. I don't know. But it must be one alcoholic talking to another in person. The human-to-human connection that we have here in meetings and that what I experience by participating in Alcoholics Anonymous at any level, whether it's sitting across the desk or a table with a sponsee, or whether it's just going to an H&I panel, or whether it's doing some like distant panel that I'm like intergroup rep, Southern Cal, H&I, blah, whether it's that, it's still one to another. There's never going to be a Google search that's going to replace the information I'm going to need to get from your personal experience. And I only know that because I really know that I tried that stuff. I really did try. I'm a problem solver, self-reliant to the core. And there's never been a relief greater. And I've done a lot of self-work, guys. And, you know, I used to joke around that my most important and long-standing successful relationship was with my therapist. We were together for 7 years, you know. But that was, I've done a lot of work. Nothing will ever solve alcoholism for me unlike one alcoholic talking to another. It's just my truth. If I be alcoholic, this is my experience, you know? I read it in the literature. I have the experience in meetings. And I've also moved a whole bunch in sobriety. I know that different parts of AA still have the same core requirements that I must meet in order to fulfill that, what's that word, the sufficient substitute for what alcohol used to do for me. Right, so When I came to AA, I wasn't a superstar, though. I didn't make all the mistakes. I told you about the birthday thing. Well, I've made all kinds of mistakes in commitments, taking on too much, doing too little, having to like, oh, I'm not confrontational, you know, and having to have hard conversations. I think the hardest thing I've ever, ever, ever done in my sobriety is having to tell a sponsee I couldn't help them. I mean, because you know how if you work with somebody, you work with somebody, you work with somebody, and they're like, they really, really need more than, like, that I think was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I've done all kinds of crazy things in sobriety, attempting to, like, help myself and help others. But, yeah, it's just nothing will ever beat that. So I, you know the guy that I was dating before I got sober, the one who didn't drink? Well, I met him in a meeting again. And so I ended up getting married when I was, like, 3 years sober. And I got married to him in the best of terms, you know, like in the best of attempts to like have that like sober marriage, sober life and everything. And he had a daughter and I was a stepmom. I'm still a stepmom, you know, but I thought that when you get married, you go off into the AA sunset, you know, and you just ride the wave. And it turns out that it wasn't my experience. And I stayed really active in the program and he stayed really active in the program. This was up in Santa Barbara where I used to live. And that is where I got sober. And I had to make amends with his daughter because I dated him before I had stopped drinking. And there was multiple times where I was responsible for her care where I had passed out. One time was Halloween. I was with her on Halloween. I was handing out candy, but I had drank too much. And then I had passed out on the sofa. And she didn't really notice because she was having a fun Halloween and I was, you know, the nodding. Little brownout, I'll call it. And so like it was really remarkable that our relationship could have been restored in that way. And I really just thought it was gonna be fantastic, right? But he changed his mind about wanting to have kids. And that's okay too. Like I really wanted to have kids. And he was really fulfilled by his daughter and he realized that wasn't gonna be the path for him. And so we had one of those amicable divorces. I really do actually like the no drama stuff. I'm not, my sponsor's really big on the no gossip thing. And when I say she's really big on it, she tells me, Lauren, your problem is created because you gossiped. And she's like, this is your problem. And so like, but that was applied in that divorce. And so like, we're friendly. And so I dated him and we got married when I was 29. And my stepdaughter was 12 when we got married. And now she's 28 and we're still friends because I did make that amends. I really did show up for her consistently. And she had a baby a couple of years ago and that baby's gonna turn 2 in April. And like she was in my wedding when I got married the second time. Like that's how close we are. And like I'm not a grandma to her baby, like no way. Like she doesn't have that kind of, like she has a mom, you know? But her mom's really welcoming to me. And I think that's all because of this program. After her dad and I had separated, she really thought she was going to have a sibling too. So that was weird for her. We would meet before her high school started and we would go get coffee once a month. No, once a week before school started on her late days. And I absolutely loved that time. And it was something where I learned I could start showing up for myself. Not just like I was trying to do in college. It took a really long time to see a result. Same thing with these living amends. It took a really long time to see any result from her. She was really, really hurt when I disappeared the first time because of my drinking. And she was really, really trepidatious of me returning as the years progressed in my sobriety. But she was really, really happy when we could be a family. And I didn't want to rip that again because I'm sorry, that's not what this program's meant for. So I stayed in Santa Barbara for a couple of years, even after we got divorced. But I knew I needed to move back to San Diego. My parents had sold their house in Fredericksburg, and they were living in Alabama, and this was right before my ex-husband and I were getting married. I went down here for the weekend to see my family who was visiting and to go to my dad's best friend's daughter's wedding, right? It's like a country song, but that's what we did. All of the family came together for a beautiful weekend, and they were spending time with my stepdaughter. They really didn't get to spend a lot of time with us because I was really ostracized, and although this was years into my sobriety, it was not a short trip to reunify everything. It was absolutely magical. And my dad flew home to Alabama and he had a heart attack that night and he passed away in his sleep. And it was absolutely devastating. I mean, I will just say that I was more close to my dad than I was to my mom. And there was just some stuff there for me. But when he passed away suddenly, it wasn't just a crossroads for me in whether or not I was spiritually connected. It was black and white, that part in We Agnostics, that God is either everything or he is nothing. What is my choice to be? And I was having a really hard time making that decision. And I was sober for a number of years, but it was at a decision where it was like, I needed to get a bigger God. And I needed to also trust that, see, my dad had open heart surgery when I was 17 years old, getting ready to head down 805 or 15 to the beautiful border of Tijuana. And I wasn't paying attention to my dad when he had that open heart surgery, but I'd experienced many years of being able to make an amends with him. And so when I flew to Alabama right after he died, on his dresser was the Father's Day card I had just sent him 2 weeks prior. You know what I mean? And I had made these, I'd flown to Alabama on these amends trips, even though, like, how do you get to Alabama from here, guys? It's a long flight. And I was, and I didn't have the money, and it was just, but I made the priorities in order to do the living amends. And I mean, it got me questioning everything. And the losses are the losses, but the problem for me was the suddenness of it and not being able to see the bigger picture. Because that time that I had with him from when I was 17 until I was 29, those were the gravy years. Those were the years where he was living on the borrowed time. And it was me to recognize that, you know, who then made all this, meaning what great, amazing higher power had so much love for me that he didn't pass away when I was 17 and crashed out. And I had all this time to get sober and all this time to learn from him. But I did want to experience more life with him. I did like the guy. Let's be real. And so there's a little bit of that anger for me to get through. I went to grief counseling. Again, me and my therapy went to grief counseling because the big book does say that we use the tools that are available to us from outside professionals, because I needed more than just like pray for him. I also do pray for them, but I needed more. And so it got me questioning everything, and I'm so glad that it did, because it got me in a conversational way with God. When I was 5 years sober, my sponsor looked me square in the face, and she's like, Lauren, you got to stop looking at God like he's somebody you buckle in the car and you bring with me new places, and you have to start looking at God like it's somebody inside of you. Because you have to have that inside of you. You got to grow with that. And she was super kind of woo-woo in that way, where she was like looking at me being, all right, so you can do fire drills in life, but where's your insides? Yeah, and that's only from talking to her about every crazy thing under the sun. That's what we have to do, is build relationships here. You know, even if the conversations are awkward and even it just feels mechanical, I still got to try. I still got to ask. I still got to share. I still got to talk. And that's what I started doing. I started having that higher power experience inside of me. And it was just a really hard one for me. But I'm not sure if I would have stayed sober if I didn't have some of that guidance and direction to expand that. That relationship with my higher power. And I got really busy in AA too. And so I was really sad when that marriage didn't work out. But because I had all that work going on in my own recovery outside of that, I can just say that I came into the rooms here and I never left. And I got involved in a really good group, but I also never left. And so although, like, your 90 days, you know, you had to do extra research. And the program does say we must have full knowledge of our condition. And the suggestion is that if a year goes by and if I'm still not sure if I'm an alcoholic, go to the nearest bar room, try some controlled drinking, see what that's like, okay? I believed everything you said. My life experiences were painful. But I ended up coming back here and staying. And so, yeah, I got sober that day in November 20, 2005, and I've never left. But things had gone weird, right? So, like, when that ex-husband told me that he didn't want to have kids with me, it's like, heartbreak. But I kept going to my meetings. Oh, and I'm somebody that even if a breakup happens, I still go to the meeting. It doesn't matter. You just walk on the different side of the room, you know? and again, the no gossip. And my sponsor would say to me, no one gets control over the meeting. And she also, okay, so the sponsor I have now, I've had the same sponsor for, I don't know, guys, math, 11 years, 12 years. We've worked together for a really long time and we're really, really close. And she would say to me, she's been with her same partner her entire sobriety. She's like, I haven't gone through a breakup like that where you're in the same room with them and you don't want to, and she's like, you're not giving up your commitment, right? And I was like, I'm willing. And she's like, no, you're not giving up your commitment, right? And so she's had me call other women that I have never met, and they don't even live in the same city as me. And she's like, called them and asked them how they would do it when they went to their meetings and had to walk around the same space. And because they're going to date other people, and so are you, and life's going to go on. And so I did it. I called strangers, actual strangers, and I took their advice. And the really specific things, too. They're like, you say that was a great meeting, wasn't it? And then you walk away. And I'm like, what's that? She's like, that's a closed-ended statement. And she goes, and you don't hug. And she's like, you just stick your arm out. And I'm like, you don't even ask how they slept or anything like that. And I was like, oh, this is so weird. Like, I don't know how to do any of that non-leading conversation and still have it be a functional person. Because it turned, I thought this, I was so silly, guys. I thought that we would get a divorce and then I'd find somebody and I'd walk into another AA sunset right away. I did not get a date for 5 years. It was terrible. I mean, it was just like God knew what I needed. And I stayed single for a really long time. And I got down to causes and conditions. And the cause and the condition is me. And right. So I want to talk about where life is today. And I just a time check is that clock says I have like 17 more minutes. But we're not going to spend that much more time, guys. I promise you. Because that San Diego Spring Roundup flyer that you announced, you know, I went to that many years in a row. And if they still have it, I recommend running the 10K and the 5K. If you ever want to get a self-esteem boost, what you do is you sign up for the 10K, 5K run. And you're going to win, is what I'm saying. Is that it's early in the morning. It starts at like 7:30. I came in first place for the 10K for the women, and I'm not even that great. But that's when I met John. And so John was your speaker here 2 weeks ago. And so I had moved to San Diego because my mom had moved back here after my dad had passed away. And I thought, here I was all of these years thinking I'm just going to find Mr. Right. And, you know, that's not how it goes. And I ran my little 10K and he ran his little 10K. And we actually have a picture together with the trophy of first place for the guys and first place for the girls, San Diego Spring Roundup. And we didn't actually start dating then, you know, but it was the first time we met. And so that's always my joke, you know, it's like you just get active in AA and see what God has in store. Because although that was in 2015, we didn't even start dating until 2019. I had to do my own research and all that good stuff. And I don't know what stories he told you guys. Oh, but the big joke is that I'm here to rebut with the truth. I was 39 and I had completely surrendered whether or not I was going to have a family. I had completely surrendered that whether or not I was going to have any kids. I had completely surrendered whether or not I was going to ever own a home or get that whatever. It just didn't matter. I was in this place of just like, I remember, I'll never forget it. I was working with a ton of sponsees. I was super current with my sponsor. I think I'd gone to some like AA function throughout the weekend that was real hardcore and I was all jazzed. It's not like AA walks around making you feel jazz. It's just that it clears away the wreckage from my mind that blocks me from seeing the joy that's already existing in my life. And I was listening to music on my walk into my little desk job, doing more paperwork, guys. And I felt so free and so happy. And so I met John again. And I remember when I met him, I was like, oh, this is exactly the person that I've been wanting to be with. And he had a significant other. And I was like, what the heck, God? And so I call my sponsor and I'm like, I'm going to start praying for them to break up. And she said, that's not how this works, Lauren. You pray for their happiness. And so I said, I don't think you got that right. No, and that's what I did. I started praying for their happiness. And you know what, guys? It always works out. And they broke up. And but it's also with footwork too, because I said to him, like, he would text me or I would call him or I'm sitting close to him at the meeting. And when I realized he had a significant other, I was like, oh no, I'm not doing that with you anymore. And he's like, you're not even gonna text me back? And I said, no, you're in a relationship with somebody else. And he's like, not even as friends? And I'm like, I don't see you as a friend. We will not talk. And that's what I did. The end. Like, that's it. And I just didn't know how. This is the stuff I needed to learn, y'all. And so and that course ran its course. And so, yeah, I think that's the way I needed to learn how to do things regardless, because that wasn't a tool that I brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And mind you, I was 14 years sober trying to practice that tool. So sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. So, yeah, and I will just say that it is absolutely, absolutely marvelous to be with someone who I find my, like, emotional, spiritual, and family partner, equal, like the thing. I just didn't know that could really be still happening for me, because I was 39 when we were meeting. And we wanted to have kids, and then the pandemic happened and things got really weird. And the family that I was an egg donor to when I was 20 years old, when I was trying to bootstrap my way through college, contacted me. And they contacted me via email, and they said, "Lauren, we have been saving the eggs that you donated us for 20 years. We've had a wonderful family experience, and we would like to give them back to you. We would not like any money. We would just like to know if you would like to receive them or participate in them adopting them to somebody else." And I sat there and I stared at my computer screen, and I can tell you that I had an experience where I had sang prayers for 15 years of my entire life that I thought were not even utterable because they were too far gone and too difficult to realize. And my complete separation and, what's the word that I use in Al-Anon, detached with love from the outcome. And God had already planned a wonderful experience for us to receive later. It is difficult for me to articulate what that meant to me spiritually. It is difficult for me to articulate what it was like for me to be so afraid of even praying for something that I wasn't even sure was even possible to work out. That's the kind of fear prayer, the deep stuff that we share quietly here. Because someone like me had no idea that a future like that could exist. And that's exactly what John and I did. You know, we adopted back the eggs that I had donated when I was 20 years old, before I was pickled. And we had a long road, but, you know, my son's at home tonight. He's 3 years old. And when he was born, you know, he looked exactly like my dad. And it's the greatest joy in my life to be able to stand here and tell you that I'm not just I'm still a stepmom today, because my husband has a son from his first marriage. Did he tell you how many times he got married? Yes. So the fact that it's, I am wife number cuatro. And our family is complete. Our family is complete. And only in Alcoholics Anonymous can I tell you about a girl like me and how different I stand in front of you today for the person that I am today. You know, my stepson has his own life in recovery and in other things, and I love him so much. My stepdaughter, I got to see her 2 months ago with her little daughter, and we're friends. My husband and I have, you know, this mutual desire to cultivate, and I stopped working, guys. I'm a stay-at-home mom now. I used to work in downtown San Diego. I quit my job. After my son was almost 1 year old, and that's why we moved up to Riverside and we live in Menifee, because I wanted to have the opportunity to be there one-on-one with my kid, because I was 42 when I had that baby. And to be 42 years old having a baby and realizing how much I wanted that relationship in my life, I wasn't going to squander it. I still need to do my program. I'm still active in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that work that I do, thank God that I don't have to be in that office job, because I get to be there for him and I get to still do my recovery. You know, and honestly, I got to give my hat off to my husband, because he's the one that works his tail off to make this happen. It makes me incredibly emotional to realize that every prayer I've ever said has been answered, and they haven't been answered pretty, and they haven't been answered clean. Alcohol works fast. I also am an equal opportunity employer when it comes to other substances into my body, okay? Everything works fast. Recovery works slowly. And that's exactly been my experience. I've had a spiritual experience of the educational variety, and it's happened for me slowly over a period of time with a sponsor, you know, reminding me of things that I can't see. And, you know, I sit back, and if I have struggles today, which I do have a lot of struggles, being a stay-at-home parent is very difficult, supporting my husband while he works. I know it just seems like this background situation, but it's a lot. And I say that I don't have a job, but that's not true. I do. I do have a job, because it's a ton of work. And, you know, the education's on the horizon. You know, he's going to start TK in the fall, and whatever that's going to look like, I don't even know. I'm a first-timer at all of this, guys. I ask my questions. I'm asking for help constantly. But I don't know what that's going to look like, but I live the dream that I know that other people are praying for and that I used to pray for. And all of the work that goes into it, I'm just ready for the next experience, because it is a ton of work, but it is incredibly rewarding, and I don't want to miss any of it. See, that's the thing that AA has brought to me. It's willingness, patience, and labor. And I keep doing that work, and then more is revealed. And not only is more revealed to me, but it's subtle. In the community where I'm sober now, it's in Menifee, there's a place called Unity Hall. Maybe you guys have been to meetings there. It is common to be over 50 years sober at Unity Hall. It is very common to have multiple decades more sobriety than most people have been alive in the room. I am the new person with 20 years of sobriety there. It's very rare that new people come and stay, because it is so much significant sobriety. And a lot of times I'm sitting there going like, wait, I'm going to miss the message because there's so much stuff happening here. And it's difficult to fit in because I'm not at that stage in my life. I have a young child. I'm an old mom. I don't work, but I'm not retired. This is weird. And but I plug myself in to get what I can get, you know? It's really remarkable. I just try to pick up on all of the nuggets because if I'm sitting in a room with six people and there's 300 years of sobriety, like, that's weird, guys. And it's different. So I was Santa Barbara County, San Diego County, Riverside County. I'm dancing all over the place, you know? And everywhere I go, I have to equally plug myself in as if I'm a new person here. And that was harder this time around because I had the responsibilities at home. But it is working out, you know. I have a couple of sponsees. When we were at dinner, something dramatic had happened with one of them. And as I was looking at my phone, I was like, I don't even know the solution to that problem. But it's like, I still need to get out of self. And I still need that reminder, and I still need to connect, and I still need all of you, because this is short-sighted. I'm invested in this little family thing now, but I'm going to go back to work eventually, you know? And there's so much I can say, and I'm going to end with this, but as long as I keep at my uppermost solution to my problems, work with another alcoholic, it solves all of my problems. And I will most likely stay sober tonight. I don't think I'm going to drink on the way home, but that's it. It's just one day at a time. And our topic at the meeting this morning was resting on our laurels. And part of resting on my laurels for me is I'm not going to stay sober off of yesterday's meal. And so I do have a mixture of Zoom meetings. I go to some meetings online and I go to some meetings in person. And it's just because I don't have childcare all the time. But I also kind of need it because my sponsor moved to Florida. But I have to keep trying. I have to keep reaching out. And so maybe if this isn't your first time and maybe you're not sure if you're going to be able to stay continuously sober from this point on, if you keep up, I don't want to say you. If I keep applying myself, I will yield solid results. I just have to keep trying. And maybe that's not my right tree, so maybe I go to a different source. But I have to keep trying, and I will get the results because it's never failed me, even though it's been really rocky and it's taken a lot of willingness, patience, and labor. And with that, I'm going to stop. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Lauren. And let's give her another round of applause. Hope you come back to see us soon. Oh, the microphone's really high now. I don't know. Okay. I would like to also like to thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for a fantastic dinner. It was really good. It was enchiladas. We will now close in the usual manner with a prayer from our guest speaker's choice. Yes.